At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Big color, bigger savings. It's Sherwin-Williams' biggest super sale. Get 40% off paints and stains October 17th through the 27th with prices starting at $29.39. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field. All right, welcome back to Behind the Knife, and today we are really excited on our global surgery episode to have Dr. John Mira and Mark Schreim, two giants in the field of global surgery that we have been trying to get on our podcast for months now, and we are lucky enough to finally have locked them down. So Dr. Mira and Dr. Schreim, thank you so much for joining us today on Behind the Knife.
It's our pleasure. We're happy to be here.
So Dr. John Mira is the Kletgen Professor of Global Surgery and the Director of the Paul Farmer Global Surgery Fellowship. And Dr. Schreim is an assistant professor of otolaryngology and of global health and social medicine at Harvard Medical School. And he also serves as the research director at the program in global surgery and social change at Harvard Medical School. So we just wanted to jump right into it today and discuss how surgery fits in to global health. And really kind of what sparked all of our interest in this was the article that was published by both of you in How Surgery Can Fight Global Surgery in the New York Times. And we'll have this on our website for our listeners to check out. So if you guys could maybe just start off and why has surgery been neglected with respect to global health?
Well, this is John Mira, and I can make a few introductory comments, and then Mark can add to that. So I think historically there were a number of reasons. Surgery was felt to be very expensive. There was some question as to whether there was really even a surgical burden of disease that was big enough to worry about devoting resources to that. It's also felt to be very complex, so you need a lot of different things for surgery. You need an operating room, and you need nurses and scrub techs and anesthesiologists and surgeons and obstetricians, et cetera. So it seems to get very complex, as opposed to if you're giving immunizations, you need the immunization and you need someone to give the immunization. So it just seemed too complex. So for decades, really, global health and the concept of surgery weren't two concepts that were spoken of together. But fortunately, we've seen a lot of change in the last decade and certainly in the last several years.
I think also, this is Mark, I think also there's, it's not that surgeons weren't involved in global health. Surgeons were definitely involved in global health, much more so on the delivery side, instead of as much on kind of the policy level, the higher level, advocating that this should be a part, that this surgery should be a part of a functioning healthcare system. We were just doing it. And so the conversation wasn't happening, even though the surgery was on some level happening.
And this is John. I'll also add something more to that, in the sense that the concept of academic surgeons and anesthesiologists and obstetricians being involved in global surgery really wasn't discussed, in the sense that there wasn't a home in medical school. So if you were a general surgeon, there was a career pathway and a way to be promoted to professor in general surgery or pancreatic surgery or otolaryngology or whatever the case might be. But in the past, no one would have called themselves a global surgeon and said, I'm going to be promoted for my global health and global surgery activities. And that's one of the reasons that Paul Farmer really promoted the idea of having a Department of Global Health and Social Medicine in a medical school, in Harvard Medical School, and also then developing a program in global surgery and social change, because this has provided a home for academic anesthesiologists, obstetricians, trauma surgeons, general surgeons, you know, the whole surgical community to have a home in a medical school. And so, you know, a number of us now are being promoted in the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine as well as in our clinical department. So that's a big academic change.
And Dr. Mira, could you tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are? Because it sounds like, you know, you may have been on the forefronts of this global surgery movement and how you got there.
Well, I think as a plastic surgeon, I was always interested in and was involved in what people sometimes call mission trips. So in plastic surgery, it's easy to get involved in those. That's historically been part of plastic surgery and part of global health and plastic surgery. But it was initially, it was just that, the shorter term kind of vertical interventions, as people say. And then, you know, because of my involvement here at Harvard and having trained with Paul Farmer in the 90s, he got me involved with Partners in Health and trying to expand surgical care delivery within that NGO, within Partners in Health. And his argument was that, you know, it shouldn't be thought of as a separate entity, that surgery really needs to be part of healthcare delivery. And he mentioned to me once, he said, you know, it really doesn't make sense to spend thousands of dollars on antiretrovirals than to have the patient die of a perforated appendix. So he's always believed in the holistic nature of healthcare delivery and in, you know, the equity argument around healthcare delivery. So it was a gradual thing in terms of answering your question, how did I get involved? It just a little bit more each year, more involvement with Partners in Health, more involvement in developing systems as opposed to purely vertical approaches, and then being involved in the Lancet Commission, which then changed the nature of our program in global surgery and you know, had impacts in the global surgery community at large. So it was more of a gradual thing. I can't honestly tell you that 15 or 20 years ago, I would have told you exactly what I'd be doing now.
Dr. Schreim, did you have a similar path or you have a little different?
You know, I went into medicine with the specific aim of doing global health. In fact, thought I was going to be an ID doctor or a nephrologist, and turns out that they are much smarter than I am. So I knew I kind of wanted to get into global health. And after did some, similar to John, did some sort of mission trip type things as a medical student, but then didn't really do a lot in residency and fellowship. After my first fellowship, I got involved with an NGO called Mercy Ships that I started doing surgery in West Africa with. And after kind of working clinically for a few years, I realized that I wanted to be more involved on the policy level, you know, on the policy side of things, at the policy level, in changing global surgery. So I pretty significantly cut back my practice and went to get a PhD in health policy. And then honestly, happened to be in the right place at the right time as the Lancet Commission got started, and John was looking for somebody to do some economic modeling, which is the focus of my PhD. And yeah, the rest is history.
So diving in a little bit further, with respects to global surgery, I'm sure you have to kind of have a focus to make it our investments worthwhile. So what are the surgical diseases that are most prominent, and how do they differ from Western countries, and which ones are, in a broad sense, are we trying to focus on to train surgeons over there to treat?
Well, I'll let Mark talk a bit more about the economic issues and cost effectiveness work and cost benefit and that type of thing. In terms of surgical diseases, I guess in one sense, you know, human beings have similar diseases whether they're in Boston or Bangkok. So that misses the point a little bit. You might say, and you might properly say, that certain diseases have late presentations in resource-poor settings. So you might see diseases that have progressed beyond a point where we might see them in Boston. And you could also make the argument that, you know, infectious diseases, for example, the prevalence of untreated infectious diseases might lend itself to certain disease presentations that have surgical treatments that we might not see. You know, typhoid perforation is not terribly common in Boston, but it's common in low-resource settings. So there is some difference, but I wouldn't say that, you know, they're are entirely different human diseases. Now, in terms of then what should we focus on, you know, when speaking about the Lancet Commission, we stopped shy of coming up with a list to say that, you know, these are the top things that you should focus on. Other organizations have done that, and I'm not saying that's wrong, and I think at some point governments have to prioritize and say, okay, we're going to at least start here. We stopped a little bit shy of doing that just because we talked more about platform building, about building horizontal health system strengthening, building capacity horizontally, in the sense that it's a tiny bit artificial, and because once you build, for example, a functional district hospital, you might say we're going to start with the bellwether procedures that the Lancet Commission talks about, but it's very easy then to do other things. So to bring in a group to do cataracts or to do cleft lip and palate or to do other types of procedures. So we didn't want to say that you should only be doing the top 20 or top 44 procedures. Although I would certainly say that many countries will have to scale up in some logical fashion. So I also don't want to be critical of that approach. It's just that it isn't the total answer.
Well, the next question I have is, can you speak a little bit, maybe Dr. Schreim, talk on how the economic and health outcomes argument, you know, leads to a push to increase funding for global surgery?
Sure. I think I can build a lot on what John said. When John started his first answer about why surgery was neglected, talking about how surgery is this very complex thing to deliver, which is true. It really is a complex thing to deliver. To be able to provide safe surgery, you need more than a pill. You know, you need safe, reliable oxygen, and electricity, and water, and training, and biomed tech, and all that. So the upfront cost is potentially larger than if you simply want to do a vaccination program. But then the downstream benefits are big because of that. Because surgery is a little bit more complex to set up, by setting it up, you end up having these positive externalities, these spillovers, that can potentially really improve the entire health system. And so the economic arguments become, on some level, a little bit harder to model, because modeling all those positive externalities is difficult to do. But the economic argument does become stronger, because once you have that district hospital in there, as John said, the marginal cost of adding a different type of procedure, if you've trained your surgeons to be able to do a laparotomy, the amount extra that you'd have to do to have them do a hernia is essentially zero. So that's kind of broad strokes. There have been a number of studies that have shown pretty conclusively that in a cost per benefit type ratio, surgical interventions are as cost effective as some of the other things that we've already decided as a world we're going to fund. They're as cost effective, sometimes even more so than antiretrovirals for HIV, than some vaccinations. And the potential economic benefit to a country is pretty huge. There was some modeling that was done for the Lancet Commission that showed that if we don't do anything to improve surgery, the economic loss to a country's GDP is on the order of about 2% of the entire country's GDP over the next 15 years, which is double the GDP loss from something like malaria, which is something the world has already sort of decided that we want to address. So the potential economic benefits from this are pretty huge.
So most of our listeners are probably not in tune with the specific aspects of global health. But I'm wondering, on an economic basis, on as far as funding goes and addressing these issues, who, as a program, as the Paul Farmer Global Health and Surgery Program, where do you guys approach getting funding from? Do you want their own states to invest in themselves, their own countries to invest in themselves? Do you rely on who, or is this on sort of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's just philanthropists? How do you guys approach getting funding to increase surgical care?
Well, that's a good question. This is John, and I guess the short answer would be all of the above, and it really depends on the country that you're discussing. So there are certain countries, for example, you can look at Sierra Leone. There's no possible way you could turn to Sierra Leone and tell them that they need to mobilize internal resources to completely rebuild their surgical infrastructure. So they have a huge task ahead of them, and I think that's a situation where external funding is critical, very legitimate, absolutely necessary. And then you need to talk about, is that World Bank, is that Clinton Foundation, Gates Foundation, you know, et cetera. And then there are another set of countries, that maybe middle-income countries, that might have the internal resources. So then you're talking a little bit more about mobilizing internal resources. And, you know, should they divert some of their tobacco subsidies away from tobacco and towards health? Should they use some of their revenue that comes from alcohol taxes to help health? So I think there are some decisions that middle-income countries could and should make to prioritize healthcare in general, but certainly surgical care. And I guess one of the things that the Lancet Commission said is maybe some of this starts with a country just prioritizing and declaring and making a plan for surgical care, because none of the ministries of health that we could find actually even had an explicit plan around surgery. So it's very unlikely that things are going to be prioritized if they're not written into the national health plan. And so that could be a first step. Then a second step would be, how are you going to pay for it? And then countries need to decide, do we have internal resources that we can mobilize, or do we need to talk to the World Bank and Clinton and Gates Foundations about helping? And then there are other sources of support, maybe not hard dollars, but you start talking about colleges of surgery and professional societies, and what can they do and how can they contribute to educational scale up, and look at the Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland and what they've done in East and Central and South Africa. So they're not everything has to be hard dollars. A lot of it can be kind of in-kind support. And industry is another potential donor and contributor and ally. So I think all of these sources need to be looked at.
This is Mark. I just want to add one other also, and that is that grant funding bodies, academic granting bodies like the NIH, there's a fair amount of money that goes into global health. It goes into the usual things that we think about with global health. And I think a stronger case needs to start being made that we can accomplish many of those things easier if we can also study and scale up surgery.
So with the global problems that we have in surgical access, as an organization, how do you go about prioritizing which countries you're going to, you know, try and impact first, which health problems? It seems just such a large issue. I can't even imagine trying to make a priority list here.
Well, this is John, and I guess in terms of which countries, I would start with the basic premise that a country has to want to work on this. So it isn't our place, and the Lancet Commission felt very strongly, it wasn't our place to tell any country this is what you should be doing. But what ended up happening is certain countries and certain ministries of health raised their hands and said, yes, we understand what you're talking about, we agree with that, you know, could we collaborate and work together on something? So it really isn't our place to tell countries what to do or to prioritize which countries should be focused on. If certain countries value surgery as part of an approach to universal health care, then I think that's appropriate. But you know, the age of kind of colonial medicine where we go in and tell people what to do, that's long past.
And
hey, it's Jason here. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit. You know, we talked a bit about how there's the upfront costs are often more with global surgery, but the sustainability cost is also higher. And setting up infrastructure and horizontal, you know, capacity building and, you know, kind of politically austere environments. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, sustainability and how you measure that and how you, you know, kind of quantify your success rate when it comes to sustainability with setting up these, you know, global surgery programs?
You know, this is Mark. That's a really good question and not an easy one to answer, partly because there's no sort of good definition of sustainability. And you'll read, if you read the global surgery literature, pretty much every program will claim that it is sustainable, but will define what they mean by sustainability themselves. So there's not a lot of good evidence out there, which doesn't mean positive or negative. There's simply just not evidence out there, period, of what actually counts as sustainable. I think all of us would probably agree that a sustainable program is a program it can be divorced from external funding, essentially. That a sustainable program is a program that, you know, we don't look at, here in the States, we don't look at, say, the treatment of, of HIV as something that is separate necessarily from our health system, that is fully integrated into our health system as something that our health system simply does. And I think that would be a truly sustainable change in these countries if surgery became the same sort of thing. That, listen, we as a health system of X country are going to be providing surgery as part of what we provide for our population. And that's just, it's now in our national plan, it's what we do. Measuring that will take some time. I mean, you can't prove sustainability in a year. Sustainability, by definition, is a long-term proposition.
This is John. I would agree with that. Everybody throws around the term sustainability, and sometimes I'm not even sure what it means, particularly when you're talking about something like surgical care. You know, in the business world, a business is sustainable if they have profits every year and they can return money to their shareholders, but that doesn't work in healthcare. In the U.S., is surgery sustainable in the U.S.? Well, I guess, because we spend 18 or 19% of our GDP on healthcare and we're willing to, you know, perform 28,000 procedures per 100,000 people, which is more than, you know, anywhere else on the globe. But so to speak about sustainability, I liked what Mark said, that you want to get to a point where countries can handle their own surgical needs and surgical capacity and training and all the aspects of surgery on their own without external funding. And then the question would be, to what extent do they want to provide surgical care? So, and then that's an internal decision. If they believe in universal health care and they want to provide, you know, equitable access to a relatively broad range of surgical care, then that is the outcome you'll have to monitor, which is why if you look at the Lancet indicators, we have indicators around financial risk protection. So is a country providing, for example, the bellwether procedures and providing the financial risk protection so that patients can actually get that care? You look at the other indicators in the Lancet Commission, what is the surgical volume of that country? What's the mortality? What percentage of the population lives within 2 hours of a hospital that can provide the bellwether procedures? So all of those indicators were meant to show, does the country have the capacity to provide surgery? Does it provide financial risk protection to the poor? Is it providing a volume that seems to be reasonable given normative values in the world and what our understanding of what surgical volume might be necessary to provide some type of modicum of surgical care. And are patients even close enough to a surgical hospital to reasonably get there in some sensible, reasonable amount of time?
Can you speak briefly on, we talked this with Dr. Riviello, on how outside or external funding coming into a country with limited resources may undermine the actual government and the state programs there?
That's a great question. I have a couple thoughts, and then if Mark has some, he can add some. This is John. During the Lancet Commission, we heard about this quite a bit, that a funder would come in and say, I have money for whatever, bed nets, immunizations, whatever. And no one wants to turn down funding, so often a country or a ministry of health will contort itself to comply with this funding, when maybe if they were left to their own devices, the country might say, well, that's great and we do need bed nets, but you know, we don't have a hospital that can even deliver babies. We don't have a hospital that can provide hernia repairs, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very easy to understand how a donor could distort the decision-making process in these countries. And we, this isn't me saying this. I remember having these Lancet Commission meetings, mm-hmm. and a number of people in various countries would say that that does in fact happen, that countries feel compelled to comply with huge funding sources because they just can't turn down the money.
Yeah, I mean, this is Mark. I'm going to agree with John on all this funding is very distortionary. You know, the quote unquote market might demand that country X really deal with its malnutrition problem. But if a funder does come in with something else, it may be that the thing that is truly the biggest demand in the country doesn't actually get dealt with because there isn't the funding for that. On some level, what countries, I think anyone would agree with, what countries need to do is strengthen their health system. That's such a broad statement that doesn't have associated pictures and stories with it. And so it doesn't generate the type of donations that something else that's got pictures and stories with it might, which is why this is me hypothesizing now, but which may be why a lot of vertical health interventions happen as vertical health interventions, because they're associated with stories that we can tell, as opposed to, I need money so I can have, I don't know, a functioning sterilizing machine.
Mark makes a great point. That a lot of funding is driven by the emotional response for a certain disease process. And mm-hmm. people, you know, can understand how horrible it is not to be able to get a C-section, or they see a picture of a cleft lip and they feel like, you know, that's just not fair, that someone shouldn't be able to receive that. And then there are other diseases that it's hard to make emotive like that, but they're just as important. So, you know, maybe, I don't know, hernias or... Mm-hmm. burns, or you know, I'm not sure, and I don't want to pick out one disease, and that's not fair, but it's just that a lot of things have been driven by the emotive nature or the visual nature or being able to craft a story. And then there are lots of things in surgery that maybe don't lend themselves to that, but they're equally important to the patient who has that problem.
So kind of switching back to from economics over there to economics here in the U.S. you know, I think it's very exciting for me because, you know, like you guys mentioned, I went into medicine because I wanted to be part of a, you know, global health. But to see these global health and global surgery programs start up, but in an environment where, you know, people are coming out with, you know, $250,000 of debt, they're not making the money they used to make, you know, are you running into issues with getting surgeons involved or wanting to be involved just for financial reasons in participating in global surgery programs?
Well, I will answer that, and then I think Mark has an opinion on that as well. That's historically been a huge problem. There hasn't been a career pathway academically. There hasn't been a funding mechanism. So, you know, if you're in a small surgical department somewhere and you have, you know, eight surgeons and one of your surgeons wants to leave for 6 months, you know, you've lost 1/8 of your department's workforce. So there are some very real funding issues, you know, and how excited is the CEO of the hospital going to be when 1/8 of the general surgeons in that hospital is leaving for Africa? So those are some very real difficult questions that we've had to deal with. And, you know, part of it in academics has begun with just recognizing that it's a legitimate pursuit and having a Department of Global Health and having a program in global surgery. The next step has been recognizing it financially. So the Kletchian professorship in global surgery is the first professorship specifically for global surgery in the U.S., maybe even in the world. So getting donors to realize that it's worthy of investing money in, getting chairmen and chairwomen, chair people in surgery to recognize that it's also a legitimate academic and social cause, and that they should allow their surgeons to do these types of things. I think that's been a huge step, and I can say firsthand that the hospitals here in Boston have been really good about that, and all the chiefs that we've dealt with, they really understand the importance of global health, and they're really committed to it, and they're allowing their trainees and more their attending level staff to be involved. Now that's still, you know, and I'll let Mark talk a little bit about the problems of an early practice that still hasn't solved all the issues, but it's a long way. It's a huge amount better than a great deal better than it was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. But Mark, what's your perspective?
Yeah, no, I very much agree. I think it makes 100% sense that if I'm in Madagascar, then my department is not making money off of me at all, and my department needs to stay afloat. So it's a hard, I totally understand the position that this places everyone in. But what John's saying is right. You know, there's precedent for this. There are careers that are made in HIV globally. There are careers that are made in TB globally. So it's not like this hasn't been done before. I think part of, and I mentioned this before, I think part of what we need to get to is that a lot of people who make careers in HIV and TB globally do so with research funding to study HIV and TB globally. And I think once that starts opening up, then it will become a little bit more of a tenable, sort of sustainable career path for an individual to embark upon, because right now you guys are absolutely right, coming out with debt and with sort of a very RVU-driven healthcare financing model here in the States, it really does, I think, make it very difficult for people who want to be involved. I think there are a ton of people who want to be involved. It makes it difficult for them to do anything more than a couple of weeks on their vacation time, as opposed to making this actually a career path. And I think that is where, hopefully, if the work that John has been doing, and if my generation does things right, this might actually become something more sustainable.
Hmm. Well, continuing with that same idea of getting involved in global health and surgery, you know, how can we as surgeons or of all types, general surgeons, you know, specialists, get involved to help the cause? Do you recommend any specific organizations that maybe volunteer with or donate with?
You know, this is John, and I want to add a little bit more to the discussion on making a viable career path for, mm-hmm. for surgeons. And I guess that partially will answer your question, but it partially follows on from Mark's comments. When I look at what's happened here at Harvard, it really took three people who had the courage to make this happen. And one was the Kletchian Foundation and Carmela Kletchian, who they were willing to donate money for a surgical chair. It took number two, Paul Farmer, who oddly enough as an infectious disease doctor was willing to support that concept. And it also took a dean, Jeff Flyer, at the medical school here, who was willing to support creation of that kind of a chair. So it took those three types of people to make this happen. And I think what I'd like to see is other medical schools having their people in all of those positions be willing to make those decisions, because if other medical schools in the U.S., in Canada, in Europe, et cetera, if they start to develop an academic infrastructure in their institutions, then more people like Mark will be able to start their careers and do this. But if we don't have deans of medical schools and philanthropic funders and global health leaders in these institutions who are willing to make that kind of a commitment, it's very hard for someone like Mark, or for, you know, you guys from Madigan there, it's very hard for you guys to start your career and get into global surgery. So mm-hmm. it will take an academic institutional level commitment, you know, for all the reasons that Mark mentioned, that it's just, you know, if you're gone for a given amount of time, you're not producing anything for your institution. And that, speaking of sustainability, that makes it very difficult for your institution, as Mark said, in an RVU-driven American model.
Has anyone contacted, I mean, you guys are kind of the first to do this. Has anyone specifically contacted you maybe to think about how to start a program like this? Is anybody interested already?
Yes, this is John again. There is a fair amount of interest. I've had a number of academic institutions contact us in the U.S., in Canada, in the U.K., to ask how we started this, you know, how it's going, how they might replicate things like this. So I think, again, I give a lot of credit to Jeff Flyer and the Kletching Foundation and Paul Farmer. They've started something that now other institutions are looking at and saying, wow, if they can do that, why can't we do something like that? And the answer is, of course they can.
And I have a question. I think, you know, we talk about nowadays how there's a lack of, you know, open operative experience and resident training. And I know some people have thought that maybe some of the global surgery aspects would be a reasonable way to increase residents' exposure to surgery, as there can be high case volumes if it is set up right. Do you guys use any of this model, and is it ethical?
That's such a good question, Mark. That's such a good question, and if you look in the literature on studies that have been published about the benefits of kind of a surgical mission model, a lot of the research talks about the benefits and talks about the benefits to high-income country trainees, which I'm going to argue is not the benefit that we should be focusing on. And I think if you bring up a really good point, yes, the surgical volume is higher. Yes, if you go with John and repair clefts, or you come with me and you do some head and neck surgery, you will see things that you wouldn't necessarily see here. But I would really, really caution against that being the reason that we do this, I agree with you that we're kind of skirting on the edge of kind of the ethics of this.
Yeah, this is John. I would agree. It always makes me cringe a little bit if I hear a program director talk about how they want to get their residents down some, quote, down somewhere to, let's go down to wherever to, so that our residents can get some good experience doing XYZ procedures because we don't get enough of them here in the U.S. That's definitely not the right attitude. I'm hearing people talk a lot more about mutually beneficial relationships, and I think if you're going to have that type of a relationship, one training program to another, that's perfectly legitimate as long as you're going to your partner and they have some things that they can say to you, we'd really like it if our residents could do the following, or if our residents could come to Boston and spend some time, or if, you know, could our residents spend time with some of your attendings, that type of thing. So I think you just have to be very clear about that, and actually along those lines, in our program, we're starting, even this morning, we were talking about the concept of having an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, around how do you do research with a partner, and I think it should pertain to clinical care. What are going to be the mutually beneficial outcomes of the care delivery, the research, the education, et cetera? And it shouldn't preclude, trainees on both sides learning. In fact, I was at a meeting in Dublin several weeks ago, and Emmanuel Makasa from Zambia, hearing this discussion amongst high-income country folks, he raised his hand and he said, look, I don't think it's a problem for American or Irish trainees to come to Zambia and operate if they have a Zambian attending who is, you know, taking responsibility. And if they behave just like a Zambian trainee, and you set up a mutually beneficial relationship where our Zambian trainees can also do something possibly in Ireland or the United States, he said, that's fine. It's just not, you know, it's not appropriate to look at a low resource country as a training ground for high income mm-hmm. countries.
And then kind of on the same vein, are short-term missions helpful, or do they, as we talked about with Dr. Ravello, do they destabilize the surgical resources in that city or country?
So I don't think, this is Mark, I don't think you can make a blanket statement, yes or no, in answer to that question. I think we would all agree that what we would want is for the surgical services in any place to improve, and we would be able to help strengthen the surgical systems. I think there are cases, very much as Dr. Viola said, that in which short-term trips are not good, in which maybe they distort the market again, either by taking away cases that could be done by a local surgeon, or simply by having the population think, okay, the missionary surgeons are coming, we'll just wait until they get here. But I also think there are cases in which they are good in places where surgery simply wouldn't happen is one. But I think that's probably rarer than if you can integrate mission trips into these existing hospitals, such that these mission trips are not just 2 weeks of delivering the surgery, but they are capacity building, they are training, they do all these other things in addition to simply doing surgery.
Yeah, this is John. I would completely agree with what Mark said, and maybe also add, you have to be respectful of what the country wants and needs. And it's interesting, if you look at Rwanda, the Ministry of Health there is very prescriptive in the sense that if an NGO wants to go to Rwanda, the Ministry of Health will examine that option and say, okay, that's great, we need this and we need you to go over here and do that. So I think as long as you're working at the behest of a country, of a Ministry of Health, and you're providing a service that they want capacity, in a sense of capacity building, both in terms of clinical capacity and research capacity, I think that's certainly a good thing. I think if you just, go somewhere on your own for a week and then disappear, that's probably not a very good model.
It should also, this is Mark again, mm-hmm. It shouldn't be a surprise. We have a lot of evidence now in the States that the higher volume the center is that you're working at, the better the results are. And the truth of the matter is a lot of mission trips are not particularly high volume. And not only are they not high volume, but they are part of what makes high volume centers work so well is that the same team has been working together and knows how to work together. And all of that is taken away when you sort of come into a place and do something and then leave again. So there is some evidence that the complication rates from mission trips are higher than they are in either sort of the U.S. setting or in the same surgery being done in the hospitals by local surgeons in the local hospitals. So they're not all bad at all, but we also need to be really sort of careful of how this particular delivery model is used. And as John said, I think it really needs to be used as one lever that a minister of health can pull to help meet a need that minister has in the country.
Great. Well, I'd like to move on to maybe some of your own personal experiences in global surgery specifically. And we mentioned, previously when we said an outline that we like to discuss an operation with you that you may perform in such as, say, Africa, where, many surgeons in the U.S. would be uncomfortable or unaware how to treat here in the United States. Is there anything that really stands out to you with that type of situation?
I guess I would say there are, as I said before, there are some infectious diseases that lend themselves to surgical treatments that we might not see a lot here. So the thoracic surgeons and tuberculosis, for example, there are a different set of surgical remedies in low-resource settings that have high TB, and we might not see that very much in the U.S., typhoid perforations in the abdomen. So we might not see that very much in the U.S. So there are certainly things like that. And then I guess the other category would be the extreme, extreme late presentation of things that we might see here in the U.S., but we wouldn't see a parotid tumor that's the size of a basketball or a thyroid tumor that's the size of a basketball. So late presentations, surgical disease related to infectious disease, those are probably the types of things that you would run across.
This is Mark. I'd also add that some of the, at least in the head and neck, some of the reconstructive techniques that we use here are very resource intensive and very personnel intensive. And so often I'll find myself reverting back to techniques that you only quote unquote read in the textbooks, because here I could do a, you know, scapular tip free flap to reconstruct the maxilla, and that's just simply not going to happen. A, it wouldn't happen because the resources aren't there. And B, if I'm working with a local surgeon and we do a few free flaps and then that local surgeon goes back to his or her hospital and doesn't have the resources themselves to do it, why sort of train that instead of training what actually can be done right now with the resources available?
And Dr. Meir, just as we're getting close to closing out here, I was wondering, can you tell us both one of the things in the past maybe 10 years that global surgery that has happened in Africa that you are most proud of, and then maybe a failure or something that we've missed the mark or the biggest need that you foresee in the next 10 years as far as global surgery goes?
Well, I think the greatest transformation I've seen in the last 10 years relates to how our community has come together. So if you even look over the last maybe 3 years and how the WHA resolution has passed in the World Health Organization, and how disease control priorities 3 volume of textbooks came out with 1 volume for surgery, and how the Lancet Commission came out. All of these things coming together have really changed the way our community has worked together, and it's also changed the profile of global surgery within global health. So now we have ministries of health that are asking if they can put together national surgical and anesthesia strategic plans. So that, I think, big picture wise, is the greatest shift I've seen. And the next thing, which we talked about a little bit already, is the other change that I've seen, which has been fairly dramatic over the last 2 or 3 years, is at an academic center, having a med school that's been willing to help promote the concept of an academic global surgeon or anesthesiologist or obstetrician. So those are sea changes that maybe 10 years ago people would have thought were completely impossible. And it was just really a huge community effort, including academic institutions, including The Lancet, which helped with this, other journals which are now publishing more global surgery papers. So just a huge monumental change across all of those areas, which again, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have dreamt would have been the case.
That is great.
Dr. Schreim, do you have anything else to add, maybe about a success or failure that you've seen in your time in global health?
Actually, I want to go back to the last part of the question that you asked John. I think one of the challenges ahead of us is to maintain this momentum and not to sort of refragment, because it's really become a unified community right now. And so to kind of keep, I hate this phrase, but to sort of keep on message and to continue this momentum, I think right now in the next year or two is a really crucial time for this field. Does it become a field? And I think the indications are that yes, it's going to. Does it become a field? Does it become something that WHO wants to collect and monitor, and the World Bank is interested in? And you know, as fields grow, they will fragment, and that's sort of natural. But the longer we can keep this momentum going, the better. I think that's one of the big challenges ahead of us.
This is John. I'll add a couple more things. I'm curious, this podcast, is this primarily a North American audience?
Actually, we have a growing international audience as they've both we see in Asia, Australia, New Zealand, and there are a few Rwandan listeners I know of, but primarily, yes, in North America.
All right. Well, then I guess in terms of, I wouldn't say areas where we've missed the mark, but things that we need to pay attention to in the future, the next 24 to 36 months are going to be really important. So there are a couple very specific things that I would recommend or asks that I would have for the international global surgery community. The first is around indicator collection. So the World Bank has now accepted the six Lancet indicators as part of their World Development Indicators website. That's a huge moral victory. And now we have to be advocates for our surgical patients and get ministries of health and the World Health Organization to help sustainably, and there's that word again, but sustainably collect these indicators, send them to their get them to the Ministry of Health, get them to the WHO, and the World Bank is glad to take that information from the WHO and publish that every year or two on their WDI site. So from an accountability standpoint, that's huge. And there have never been surgical indicators on the World Bank website. So that's number one. I think number two would be advocating for funding agencies to start providing funding for surgical initiatives. So whether that's USAID or World Bank or Gates, you still have a hard time on their websites finding any funding streams related to surgery. So, and I think that's short-sighted because even to obtain the new SDG targets, whether it's maternal or child health or infectious disease, surgery needs to be a partner in that. So as I said, number two is changing funding streams so that people recognize surgery as something legitimate to fund. And I think three, in academic institutions, we still need to advocate in medical schools, for example, that this is a viable career for academicians, and you don't have to do, basic science, that if you have an interest in health equity, that's just as valuable as someone who has an interest in genomics. And in fact, I'm sure there are ways that global health folks will start collaborating with genomics experts and leveraging their work in other countries. So the two are not mutually exclusive. And then the other area that I would say we need to advocate in is in our professional societies, so in colleges of surgery, anesthesia, and obstetrics, that we have some very affluent colleges, particularly in North America and Europe and Australia, and I personally think that they should take part in this and that their activities should not just be domestically related. And you see where a number of countries have done a wonderful job. The Irish College has been very involved in Africa. The Australian College of Surgery has been very involved in the Pacific Islands and in all of Australasia. So there are exemplars. There are colleges that have done this right, and I shouldn't just be naming surgical colleges. I'm sure there are anesthesia colleges and obstetric colleges that have done the same. But I think we need to advocate at that professional level as well. So I think we still have a huge advocacy task ahead of us, and I wouldn't want anybody to declare victory too soon and just be happy with the WHA resolution. I think there's a lot of work to do still.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to help highlight the issues of global surgery, and I know some of our listeners out there will be encouraged and inspired to pursue global surgery thanks to your guys' discussion. And we finish out every podcast with what we call final five with all of our guests. And it's just five quick questions to get to know you a little bit better. And the first one, and we'll just, either one of you can answer, is do you guys in Africa, when operating, do you guys listen to music in the operating room? And if so, what type of music?
I actually don't. I like my operating room kind of quiet and zen.
I'm different. I don't mind music, and I'll listen to whatever the rest of the team wants to listen to. I'm always interested in something different.
Well, question number two is: do you have any hobbies, talents, or interests outside of the OR or medicine totally?
Are those allowed?
Excluding, yeah, excluding global health.
What are hobbies?
This is Mark. I'm a pretty avid rock climber.
And I'm a semi-retired runner. I used to do it more, and I need to get back into it. But I love running. I've just been on hiatus for about the last 6 to 9 months.
I heard there's a big group that does the Boston Marathon every year from your department. Is that true?
Yep. Dr. Riviello did it this year. We were very, very proud of him. He's done that several years in a row, so he's shaming me. I need to get back to work.
This isn't our typical number three question, but I'm changing it up given the global health nature. What is one characteristic or trait that you have seen in surgeons, either trainees or attendings in Africa, that you wish your trainees in the U.S. Would learn or use?
You know, I wouldn't say that there's something that I've seen just in the trainees in our low and middle income country partners. Because I see it in our own med students and fellows in our own program, and I would make this comment of both sides of the Atlantic or Pacific, if you will, that there's an incredible amount of passion around social justice, health equity, a willingness to give back, maybe more so than I saw in my own training days. So, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, this wasn't quite, I don't feel like it was as palpable. And now, whether you're talking about American or Canadian trainees or trainees in other countries, the concept around giving back and social justice and health equity seems to be much more spoken and much more palpable. But I see it on both sides of the equation, and that's why we have 25 people starting in the program on global surgery and social change in July, because it's not just occurring in other countries. I see it in the U.S. and Canada and Australia and Europe.
Yeah, this is Mark. I agree with John. I think trainees are trainees kind of everywhere. There's a lot of, I guess hunger is the best word. I've just so many times had trainees just kind of show up in the operating room because their other operating room was done and they wanted to scrub in mine. But I also think that's both when I'm in Africa and also here in the States.
Question number four, what would you be doing if you were not in medicine?
Well, you stumped both of us.
I think if money weren't an object, like if I could just sort of magically not have to eat cat food, I'd be a photographer for National Geographic.
You don't like eating cat food?
I don't like that.
You know, I'd probably want to work for USAID or the World Bank or do something like that, or work in the State Department. Something like that, I think.
Great. And our last question, if you could go back in time and see yourself on the first day of internship, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
Wow. You need to show us a Rorschach test next. This is like a neuropsych test. what advice would I give myself?
These are hard questions.
It's the last one. That was it.
Well, you know, it goes a little bit back to what I said before. When I was an intern, I was not as like socially aware as I see the trainees now. So, you know, maybe if I could have told myself that earlier, but again, it's almost like it was culturally different back then. I mean, people weren't talking as much about that. Although I knew, you know, I trained with Paul Farmer in the 90s. He was at the Brigham as an ID doc, and I was a surgical trainee. And of course, he was already getting into global health at that time. But that was very much different, and I guess I didn't realize at the time how important that was. That's the best I can do. Maybe if I could have come to that realization a little bit earlier in my career.
Definitely.
Dr. Shrine?
I'm trying to think back to the things that I felt when I was an intern. I would say fear was the dominant emotion. So I would really say that I would say to somebody who's an intern right now and feeling like, gosh, what did I bite off? I would say that you're where you're supposed to be, and that imposter syndrome is real, and that the fact that you might be feeling like you're not where you're supposed to be is on some level probably just all in your head, and sort of put one step in front of the other.
Great.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us at Behind the Knife, and I know this will be a much listened to and enjoyed episode.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. What you're doing is very important, and we appreciate it.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in again today. But before you go, we have Dr. Meir back to explain two aspects of the podcast that we did talk about quite a bit, and that includes the Lancet Commission and the Bellwether procedures. So here's Dr. Meir talking first about the Lancet Commission.
Okay, so I can try to give a brief summary of that. So the Lancet Commission is a process that the Lancet Medical Journal in London started probably about 10 years ago. And every year or so, they pick a condition that they think is important in global health, and they convene a commission of 20 to 30 or so world experts to examine that problem and come up with solutions. So the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery was just to do that, to examine what's happening in the world. Richard Horton, who's the editor, asked us very specifically to come up with some recommendations, and he also very specifically asked us to come up with indicators so that the surgical community could keep track of whether it was improving the surgical situation globally or not. And I would add that Jim Kim asked us to do the same thing when we had the first meeting of the Lancet Commission. He specifically asked for time-bound targets for global surgery. So that was what we were meant to do. We met over the course of about 18 months. Our commission was a little bit different in that we had a second group of commissioners meet in Bellagio after we had had the first three meetings to review the document as it was at that point, because we wanted to get some other opinions. And we also had a number of regional meetings, which were very helpful to make sure that we got opinions from around the world. We then published that document along with over 100 other publications and abstracts in 7 different journals. So it was an interesting process. It wasn't just one publication in the Lancet journal. It really became a worldwide project, over 100 countries involved, hundreds of people involved in the process, maybe 500 or more. I'm not sure how many ultimately became involved in the process. And that publication was finally completed in April of 2015. And some of the things that came out of that which have had an impact are the call for national surgical strategic planning. So there's a quote, famous quote from Alice in Wonderland that if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. And that was our feeling, that if a ministry of health or a government doesn't even have a plan for surgery, it's hard to get anywhere, quite frankly. The other thing that came out of the commission was the 6 Lancet indicators, which have now been accepted by the World Bank and will be published on their World Development Indicator site. 4 of those indicators already, we've collected the data, and they are actually online at the moment, and we're doing work on the other 2. So those were the 2 major things. We also had a number of recommendations in the areas of workforce and care delivery and information management, etc. So there were some more granular recommendations in those areas. But what you see now is that our call for national strategic planning has really taken off, and a number of countries are beginning that process. The World Bank has accepted those indicators, and we're now in discussions with the World Health Organization about how can the global surgical community continue to collect those indicators as a means of accountability to show what's happening across those indicators. And the other concept that was interesting that came out of the Lancet Commission was that of the bellwether procedures. So what we found is that district hospitals that can provide cesarean deliveries, open fracture treatment, and laparotomy procedures those were the types of district-level hospitals that could provide a much broader range of surgical care, and that speaks to the whole idea of platforms and systems, that you don't order up 100 hernia repairs. You have to have a hospital that can provide a reasonable range of surgical procedures. And once a district hospital can do those three bellwether procedures, it's set up to safely do other things. So if you want to have a group come in and do cataracts, and you have a district level hospital that is appropriately appointed, as I just mentioned, then they can do cataracts fairly easily. If you have a group that wants to come in and do cleft lip repair, then that's also possible as well. And we found this by doing some research with the WHO to look at different district hospitals and what their capabilities were, and we found that those three bellwether procedures were the best predictor of hospitals that could provide a broader range of treatment.
Well, that does it for us today on Behind the Knife. We thank Dr. Meir and Dr. Shrine for joining us today. We will have at least one other episode on global surgery with Dr. Riviello, and possibly a few other future guests. Also on the agenda, we are working on organizing a episode on advice for new surgical chiefs, and that should be out in the near future. And once again, if you have any suggestions for any episodes, please send them our way. We are doing our best to incorporate all those suggestions into our podcast agenda.
Until next time, dominate the day.